My name is Dennis Clahussy, and I'm composing music for theatre, film, television, radio. I studied music in Maynooth College, and I was there for 4 years. I studied composition with John Buckley, and then I went on to do a course in film scoring with Screen Training Ireland.
I'm Ivan Berthel. I'm a composer, musician, sound designer. Been working in theatre for about 10 years. Been in plenty of bands before that. I started playing guitar at about the age of 14. I have signed to Columbia Records with Stim, played with Nina Hines and the Husbands, played with Nina for a good few years.
My name is Vincent Doherty. I'm a composer, sound designer, working in theatre, occasionally in radio. I've no formal training as such. Started playing music when I was a teenager, various bands. Graduated onto acting for a while by mistake and went back to music again.
I used to perform in a band called The Prayer Boat, who I'd done some string arrangements with in 1998, and that kind of got me introduced into doing music professionally, and I'd done the Screen Training Ireland course in film scoring, so I started doing some short films out of that. But then my first theatre gig was in the Crypt in Dublin Castle, where I did a production of Glass Menagerie, and which went on to do very well. It got nominated in categories in the Irish Times Theatre Awards and stuff like that, so I basically felt, I really like this. I want to stay involved in something where this kind of approval rating.
I started off playing in bands up in Derry after school. I'd moved up there when I was 16, and it was like the second main band that I was in there. Stum was formed, and we played a lot of gigs around the place. It was myself, Christian McNeil, James Cunningham, and Rory McCarron. Played in the Guido Bar quite a lot, packing the place out. We played all around the country for a number of years. We had Paul McLoon and Billy Doherty from The Undertones managing us. So that kind of opened up a few doors. They were great. And you know, we had a couple of the lads from U2 used to come along and hear us now and again. Like, and Larry Mullen, Adam Clayton used to come along and see us now and again. And Owen McGowan was working for Sony Music here. He traipsed around and finally got assigned to Columbia, UK, and to work over in the States as well. And from there, we recorded, you know, a few EPs, an album, toured quite extensively around the UK and the States. And when our musical differences came to a head, I left Derry then and returned to Dublin.
I probably didn't do my next show till 99, so that was with Liam Halligan, and it was a show called Cracked, where we had three very talented actresses who all played instruments as well. So they performed live, and it was a devised show. So it gave me a lot of scope for composing, which again encouraged me further to stay in that area, because I was working with IMRO at the time, which are the Irish Music Rights Organisation, who distribute and collect royalties. I'm sure some people know them and some people wouldn't be so fond, but for those of us that compose music, they're a really important organisation, because a certain amount of our income each year, which to be honest, in theatre land is pretty limited, can come from royalties. So it's just a really important organisation for us. So anyway, I was working with them for about 7 years. I was distributing royalties on live performances. So if someone played at Slane, I'd collect a set list from the promoters, and then we'd get a licence fee and we'd distribute the money across the set list that was performed. So all the composers were getting money rather than the actual performers, which is the important and unique selling point of IMRO. So I was doing any composition on the side, but I knew that I kind of wanted to stay there because of the kind of, definitely the satisfaction I was getting from that. And really it was like one gig a year, one show a year, trying to knock on the door and break into it, but finding it very difficult. And then in 2005, I did Titus Andronicus with Selena Cartmell, and that went on again to win various awards, and essentially the phone kept ringing after that.
Myself and Ivan have been working since 10 years ago. We met around the time that Semper Fi were doing Butterflies above the International, and it was Carl Shields that suggested that we talk, and he said, you know, he reckons you'll get on. So we got on grand and went back. I think we went back to the house then and did some collaborations, some noises that were non-theatre related, and figured out we had the same sort of outlook, sense of humour and all that kind of stuff. So I think after that then, Ivan was more a technology man than I was at the time. I wasn't even using a computer at the time. I was using ridiculous four-track cassette players and stuff like that, mini disc players and nonsense. But he sort of introduced me to technology then, and ways to sort of further things and further explore sound in that regard. So I think around the time of 2002, the Bedrock show we were about to do was called Massacre at Paris, but but I couldn't do it because I was going to do Lolita in the Peacock at the time with Corn Exchange. So I said to Jimmy Fay that maybe you could talk to Ivan Berthesel about taking over from it. So the pair of us sort of sat down together and made sounds for it. So initially that was the first collaboration from there. And that kind of led on to more, I think, My Children, My Africa was a Gala Glass show in February of 2003. And then we didn't really talk or see much of each other for the rest of that year. And at the very end of 2003, we sort of decided to join forces officially and have been working since.
I'd also done some, started doing some documentary work with various TV directors. So I was getting more of a handle on things there. And I actually went part-time in Imro. And then I left Imro completely and essentially became full-time independent. I haven't looked back since.
I started in 94 on a show called Hamlet Machine, the kind of obligatory student production that everybody does when they're studying and they're starting off. It's very heavy theatre, shall we say. So I came in, I met a woman called Susan Church who said, do you want to come in and talk to a director about some music? And I went, grand. The next thing I know, I had the job and I was using tape loops and stuff like that. It was in the Ormond Multimedia Centre in town, which thankfully is no longer there. But we were in there, I think I got paid like 100 quid for it, and we were working in conditions where there was water running down walls and you had to operate your equipment with gloves on and all this kind of stuff. But that kind of led on to a relationship with Bedrock Theatre Company, and that kind of lasted a long time, which was very nice and very rewarding work, because the next show was Jimmy Fay doing Arturo Uy for the first time, which is a really, really good production. That was the second thing I ever worked on. And I thought, you know, as Dennis says, you know, this kind of, it looks up from here and you think, grand, this is going to be good.
So in this piece you're hearing now, this is from My Cousin Rachel, which is running currently in the Gate until early next year. It is essentially written for, it's actually ukulele, cello and some atmospheric instruments as well. So I was basically, I'd had a couple of discussions, I'd read the script and I had a couple of discussions with Toby Frow, the director, and we were kind of talking about the cello as Philip's instrument and some other instrument as Rachel's instrument, but we weren't quite sure. And I'd recently bought a ukulele in the States and I was messing around with it, and it kind of reminded me of a kind of a mandolin sound. And the lead actress in the play, Hannah Yelland, who's playing Rachel, is playing an Italian countess who's come over to this family house, and I don't have a mandolin, so I thought the ukulele kind of sounded in that Italian world. I basically did a demo version of the theme for My Cousin Rachel, and the ukulele that I was performing was kind of representing the Rachel character. But then I also got a great performance from Kate Ellis, who was playing cello, and she was performing essentially Philip's theme, who's the male protagonist in the production. So it's a kind of combination of these two themes coming together with the cello and the ukulele playing alongside. And it, you know, it shifts through various keys. It's in a kind of, it moves from a minor key up to a more positive major key, and then kind of some other stranger chords just to give it an add, because it's a thriller piece essentially. So just to give it a kind of an exotic edge, I suppose, just to give some strange chords in there, just to add to the listener's pleasure, I hope. The first time it's presented is when we meet Rachel, when she first enters the house. And what was great for me is that Toby gave me a bit of space, and it, you know, so the music plays while she's having a look around, and there's an image built, which is always nice when that works well with music. The second time we hear it, it's when there's a kind of a coming together, a joining up of the two characters where they have an interaction. And then towards the end, so it's actually only used three times in the whole piece, but by the time it gets to the end, I think it's become quite ingrained in the production, and it feels like it's an integral part of the piece. There's references to it throughout the show in very limited kind of manners, just a kind of reminder of what the theme is. But, you know, as they say with the James Bond theme, you only use it three times for the big moments, and that's all you need.
So the piece you're hearing at the moment is from the Lane production of The Field that took place in the Gaiety at the beginning of last year, 2011, directed by Joe Dowling and starring Brian Dennehy. The way we treated the music was we wanted to give it an Irishness, but we didn't really want to go Irish on it, so we took a fairly blank piece of cello recording that I already had, cello very nicely played by a cellist called Aaron Rowe. We added bass to it, or various instruments to it as the play progressed, giving it more emphasis as it went by. So it was sort of a, there were two main themes. This music is more for scene changes as they went by, and there was another piece that was marked beginning and end of it as well. So we added various instruments to that piece as we went by, but this is the, what you hear now is the core cello that we had sort of as a theme going through.
The piece that you're hearing now is Man of Valor. This is Paul Reed's one-man show that we did with Corn Exchange. Basically, this is an idea that Paul Reed had developed in a workshop with Annie Ryan and Michael West. They have these famous Corn Exchange workshops where various things happen, but he improvised this character for about 10 minutes where the storyline is essentially about this office drone, as the caption titled it. So he was essentially a guy who was very shy, you know, socially very awkward, you know, he fancied a girl in the office, all this kind of thing. So he really had no outlet for these kind of imaginings. So he goes home at night and he plays on his Xbox and he eats his cold pizza, and that's life. So the an event happens in his life where an event from his father's past comes back, and this triggers all these various memories, and it just goes into this kind of super kind of extraordinary line. I mean, it was an extraordinary performance from Paul Reed, who, you know, just did a great job in it. And he captured just so many characters in like three or four movements, you know, and essentially it was about an internal soul being destroyed at the same time as just being a physical comic. So he just managed to encapsulate so many things in just a really great performance, actually. So the idea of it as well was that it was kind of like a film score, and like an action hero film score. So obviously, you know, we're on a low budget and we didn't have orchestras and the like to hand. But what most composers will have in their studio now is sample libraries, which is essentially what happens is that some guy in Vienna, the ones I have in particular in Vienna, they hire in an orchestra, and all the cello sections will play a low C, you know, legato, for example, or pizzicato, and then you can play back that same note on your keyboard and you can select which ones you want to play. So it's all built up from there. There's also drums that you can hear in there as well. There's me playing a bit of guitar. There's a choral sample of choirs that are just shouting O, A, etc., things like this. And we were actually discussing what kind of gender the choir should be. Should it be a female, male, our boys' choir, in fact, for quite a while, but we came up with the female choir. So essentially, it was go as mad as you can, and that was one of the best things I've ever heard from a director. I think Annie had thoughts about a couple of different people to use for composing music on it, but she eventually said, okay, Dennis, you give it a go. So I'm a big kind of fan of going crazy with music if I can get a chance. Now, I don't often get a chance, but basically Annie Ryan said to me, anything you do can't be too over the top. You know, just do as much as you can. So that's exactly what I did. Paul basically had developed the character, but then we got down to kind of rehearsals and workshops, and they were developing, you know, Michael and himself had come up with the various storylines and stuff like that. So they were trying out various vignettes in there. And what I would do is I'd go in actually with my, you know, my smartphone camera, and I would film Paul doing his various bits and pieces. I would go home that night, put it into the computer and actually scored a picture. And then I'd come in the next day and say, right, this is the bit where you lift your hand up in the air and you turn around, because there was actually no text or very little text in it. So essentially the whole piece was scored. And I think for him, it was a good way of helping him remember the ideas he had and what he had done and what was working. And, you know, we were able to chop and change all these things and kind of move them from one place to the other. So it felt pretty symbiotic in terms of how it developed.
There are kind of two main types of script that we get, and the first one would be where you have kind of very obvious scene change things and spot effects, and you have your dialogue. And we've been working a lot in dance for the last number of years with Kush Kame, David Bulger. You don't have a script, so you have to try and figure out what's happening somehow.
That's where the smartphone use comes in. With dance, you'll film it and take it home, what Dennis has done, and just basically compose to that. The piece you're listening to now is from the very beginning of the show, As You Are, which was choreographed from Myrna Bloomer. It was part of a double header with Kush Kame's production of As You Are, Fawn, back in 2010. This is kind of the beginning of the show. It's sort of an establishing sound, rather than sort of... It's kind of like a bed of sound, basically, for other events to drop in, and for the actors, or rather, pardon me, the dancers were not moving in huge dance form at that stage. They were kind of slowly, it was evolving basically at that stage, so we were trying to recreate primordial soup or something with that. The piece is about humanity, I suppose, and its arrival at itself over the course of 45 minutes.
Well, Myrna Bloomer was choreographing this piece, and she had a few ideas about various things that she wanted, like Miserere, a bit from The War in the Worlds, and we'd given her a CD of a few pieces of music of ours that she'd liked, bits and pieces here and there. So they'd worked up basically the sketch of movement for the piece, and we went in and saw it and filmed it, and we took that away and decided where we wanted to go with that from there. And you know, it was an evolving piece, as dance generally is, so things changed quite radically. So large sections can get cut, and large sections can get inserted, so we kind of repeated that process throughout the rehearsal period.
So using music dramatically, I suppose you can take some of the more obvious examples from film. So, you know, my personal favourite film score is Once Upon a Time in the West by Ennio Morricone, which in fact was written before the film was shot, and in fact played back to the actors on set for many of the scenes. Jill's theme, for example, when she arrives off the train and there's a big sweeping shot over the train station house, was, you know, they all heard it on set, and the cameraman was doing it in time and all that kind of stuff. One of the giants again would be Bernard Herrmann, as the Americans would call him, who worked with Hitchcock on, you know, his first movie was Citizen Kane, his last movie was Taxi Driver. And, you know, in between he had Psycho, and he had North by Northwest and Magnificent Ambersons, I think, as well. So he had pretty much an exemplary kind of career in terms of composing dramatic music, I think. I'm sure he also had some work in the theatre. I don't know about that, though.
When it works and when people get it right, is that, you know, it just ties in with the rest of the production seamlessly. And I think the best scores and the best soundtracks, you don't even notice at the time. They tie in seamlessly, and you don't even notice that they're there while you're watching the piece.
Don't Look Now, Nicholas Roeg film. Pino Donaggio did the score for that, and it's really, really effective. And I was kind of blown away by it. That's one for me. I feel the score is brilliant because it's very, very atmospheric, and also the melodies are just beautiful anyway. And because of the film is set in Venice, a very off-season Venice, and I think he succeeded very, very admirably in conveying that. And I think it's quite pretty beautiful now, I'd have to say. But I'd also say sometimes an absolute lack of music is as effective as a load of music. Certain TV things, like if you watch The Wire or something like that, there's no music in it. There's no need for music in it. And it's as effective without it. There is a definite soundscape on the go, but there's no big, huge moments of, you know, crash bangy cymbals or big strings or any of that kind of stuff. I think there's a certain old fashionedness to certain scores. Some stand the test of time, as far as I'm aware, and some don't.
I think one of the big skills that Vincent was referring to is like knowing when to hold the reins back and knowing when to let them go. And I think not enough people hold the reins tightly enough.
In terms of the use of music, it depends on the, you know, the production, whether it's a theatrical production or a film production, what route they want to go down. And sometimes, you know, to use an abundance of music can be really effective because it can be overpowering, and, you know, it could be a particularly sweet theme, for example, and that displays the kind of saccharine nature of a certain character, and it becomes quite overbearing, or it can be a kind of very direct percussive kind of piece. You know, like, say, for example, the Jaws theme, which has a very kind of, you know, strong... I mean, and when people hear it, they're not going... They don't think of it as music, they think of it as the shark. And that's the trick, is to actually produce a piece that becomes so integral to the production, again, whether it's theatre or film, that it isn't music anymore, it is part of the story that you're hearing that and that's being told. And I think that's the sign of a really strong piece of work.
I was kind of trying to steer clear of influences and just kind of go with it, whatever I felt was right myself, and trust that. If you're writing a piece of music, you have to like it yourself primarily. If you don't like it yourself, then nobody else is going to like it. As Oscar Wilde said, greatness borrows and genius steals. It's kind of appropriate enough. We've just finished doing the picture of Dorian Gray on the main stage in the Abbey. Yeah, but I've always kind of just tried to trust my own judgment on what is good and what I like.
I recently saw War Horse in London. In fact, I saw it twice. I saw it in the National, in the original production, and then I saw it, they also toured it in West End. And the music in it is, first of all, there's the sung kind of element, which are all these English folk songs which have been arranged and performed live. Then there's also the score element, a lot of which is also performed live. And it kind of just ties in this whole period of, it's like a early Vaughan Williams kind of score where it's very evocative of early English countryside, but it's got an edge and a danger to it as well. And it's kind of this display of the horse and the central character of the horse, which is really brought alive by the music. So you hear this great piece of music, but you're also thinking of this central character, which is the horse. And that, again, is an example of, I thought that production particularly was a really great example of how music integrates really well.
One of the things we get to do in theatre is to really play with the space that we were in. Obviously, the audience is there with the live actors on stage. And, you know, if you've got a depth of the stage, unlike in a cinema where you have your flat screen, sure, you have your surround sound and the rest of it, we get to use behind the screen a bit more. And we can play with the physical space much more than you can in a film piece. I think it's a much more kind of direct influence on an audience as well. So it's one thing that you also have to be careful of as well. And
in terms of recorded music versus live music, they both play two different roles. I suppose with recorded music, you tend to be able to get a bigger sound because you can drop in all of these various samples, etc., that I was talking about earlier. I do think there is something there's a great value about live music, though, in terms of the intimacy with an audience. And I suppose, you know, it's difficult for a lot of production companies because it's essentially like getting another cast member in. And if it's a 3 or 4 piece band, then you're talking about an extra. So there is a large cost with it. And unfortunately, as we all know, budgets are being slashed essentially in theatre and the arts generally. So we are looking more and more towards recorded music. But those moments when you can get, you know, I remember I did a show again with Kate Ellis performing cello. And it was Kate Ellis and two actors on stage, and it's one of the productions I'm most proud of. La Musica, it was in 2003, won Best Production the Fringe Awards that year, and it was just the sound of this cello in Smock Alley, an old church, just worked so well with the performance. And you know, you can't beat that, the magic of a live performance. But there's also some things that recorded music just brings to a whole new level and a whole new epic kind of quality if necessary.
Well, years ago I worked with the Corn Exchange on a show called Foley, which was a one-man show with Andrew Bennett, written by Michael West, directed by Annie Ryan. And I played piano at the side of the stage for that, and it was a real pleasure, really lovely piece to do. But you don't really get the opportunity to do that very much anymore, because whether it's people can't afford a piano or whatever like that. But nowadays, I suppose we'd be at home with the computer composing and then flying it out through speakers, as opposed to playing live. But it is enjoyable. On if you get the right kind of show, it's very enjoyable to do.
I think it's mostly down to budgets, and people really just can't afford to put an extra couple of bodies on stage. It would be lovely to be able to use more live music in theatre, but we've only got one major company in the States, and everybody else is kind of living on a shoestring, and they're trying to make every penny count. So, unfortunately, we don't have the luxury of using enough live music.
I'd love to do a kind of a music-based piece of drama that's not necessarily a musical. In fact, I'm kind of in the process of developing something at the moment that, you know, will hopefully see the light of day in the next year or two, perhaps. But something, I suppose, a lot of the time we are a hired gun, so we come in on top of a production, and we're kind of, often we can be an afterthought, I suppose. You know, we need to get someone to do some music, some sound. But so I'd be interested in kind of developing a piece that's more a music-driven kind of piece. I suppose living the dream would be to do score maybe a film a year and three really good theatre productions. I think that'd be my living the dream.
I'd be with Dennis on the couple of films and a couple of theatre shows a year. That'd be a nice life.